Welcome to Reframed. Join us as we explore the concept of redemptive business in our unique context on the African continent.
Hello, my name is Karen and I call myself the Chief Excitement Officer of my company Cryo Slices. I will be your host for this punchy, pragmatic and inspiring series called Risk, where we aim to reframe risk through a kingdom lens. I am so excited about hosting this series because the topic impacts everyone in a career or business. And having been an entrepreneur for over 25 years, spanning the entire supply chain from research and development in the medi and aesthetics technology space, right through to global exports and raising capital at various stages, I have had to face risk on multiple occasions. Our guest today is Musyoki, who has an extraordinary story that took him from missionary work with refugees to starting and building an electric motorcycle company. Musyoki took many risks on his journey that dovetailed into a wonderful success story. Welcome, Musyoki.
Thank you very much, Karen. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for the invitation. It's been very great to meet you and have this opportunity to talk about ENZI. ENZI is an electric motorcycle company based in Nairobi, founded about 4 years ago. My journey to ENZI has been, of course, as you said, through working with the church, the not-for-profit sector, and then in the petroleum industry and business consulting, SME consulting. And then a few years ago, through just meeting the right people at the right time, got to start ENZI. We're very passionate about the e-mobility space, getting petrol bikes off the road and getting people onto electric bikes, not only because it's good for the climate, I think more than anything, it's good for the riders in terms of their ability to make a better living from the same amount of effort that they put into what is really quite a tough job for a lot of the people who do the border taxi and delivery business.
That's wonderful. I love how you're meeting such a need in the industry. It's very, very exciting. Can you tell us some of the benefits of an electric motorcycle? You touched on that and mentioned that it is great for the rider. Maybe you can go into a little bit more detail about that, especially for those who don't know much about the electric motor vehicle motorcycle industry.
Oh, I thought everybody knew how great this industry was. Electric motorbikes are great because, one, they're quiet. The first thing you find, you know, the unnerving thing actually about them is that just the sheer silence of them when they're in motion. It's very counterintuitive for most people. You know, you expect when you rev, you hear the engine, you know, pump and you know that's a motorbike coming at high speed. If it's low revs, you know it's a motorbike coming at a low speed. Electric bikes have no sound or very little sound. That's actually a very unique characteristic. That's actually we're finding that people appreciate that. Both the riders and the customers appreciate the fact that there's low vibration, low sound. And, you know, the sound does tend to affect, you know, people in the long term. You know, they do say that listening to the engines all day long, at some point it becomes an irritation. So, you know, that's a big benefit to the riders, to the users, their customers. The other thing is that they're just cheaper to operate. Electric bikes, we find on the most part, overall fuel cost and maintenance would save a rider somewhere between 40 and 50% of the operating costs. That's another big benefit, which we really believe is where the opportunity lies. As long as petrol or petroleum is significantly more expensive than electricity, we have a business. And then, of course, the fuel, which is the battery that powers the electric motorbike, is mobile. Having worked in the petroleum industry, where we work with a volatile, highly volatile fluid, liquid, which we have to transport with a lot of care, and often in bulk containers, bulk tankers, it's stored in depots and then in underground tanks. An electric motorbike battery is portable. It's heavy. But it's about the same weight as in a cooking gas cylinder, the domestic one, really. So that portability actually creates a whole new way of thinking about mobility, which as ENZI, of course, we are very eager to explore. So those are sort of kind of the top level things that make e-mobility such an exciting business.
I love that. Thanks, Musyoki. And how would you describe your target market or your customer? What is the age group? Is it men and women? Is it mostly men that ride motorbikes in Kenya? Or are you finding women are using your product as well?
No women yet. What we find, our customer tends to be male. You know, before we started the business, we actually did some pretty heavy duty market research, in depth, talking to them, many questions, many different parts of the city and slightly outside the city, to just get a different view of a deeper understanding of our customer. So our customer tends to be male, between 18 and 35 mostly. Past 35, they exist, but you know, on the curve, they're they're outliers. So they tend to ride the bike for somewhere between, you know, 15 years or so, and look to move on to something else. Many of them aspire to be the Uber drivers or just get something else, farmers. So the border tends to be something that creates employment for young men coming out of school. It's something they can easily access because the financial solutions around that are within reach for most people within Kenya. So that's why it's been such a big boom in motorcycles over the last 20 years. So they access that, they get employment, and they really do see themselves as business people. But they're a vital part of the modern Kenyan economy, and I think a modern African economy in many ways, because they do provide last mile delivery for so many companies, at least in Kenya, and I know, you know, many other places. Mm-hmm. People, they have become such a part of our lives. We can't remember when it was difficult to get things done quickly, or people moved, or goods, parcels, letters, equipment. This morning, my headset was delivered to me by a boda rider. I sent him a text in the middle of the night. In the morning, he picked it up from, you know, my partner's house and brought it to my house and just dropped it off at the door, took off, and he'll send me a bill later. You know, I don't even have to pay cash on the spot. They've weaved themselves into how we live. And so our customer really is someone who is, every other person in the country is almost a user of our customers' services, because there's that deeply embedded into the fabric of how our modern economy functions.
Is there any resistance in your industry, or was there any resistance initially? I've watched many debates on podcasts and YouTube videos between the petroleum industry and the electric industry. Did you find there was any resistance? And if so, from what sectors of the market?
We're still in the trenches trying to defend against all the arguments against e-mobility. The resistance is strong because we are compared with one another, but also compared with the petrol bikes that are on the road. And so, like in all industries, I think the early products that came to market were not the greatest. And so people's early experience of e-mobility was a product that was, you know, the only selling point was that it's not petrol. Performance wasn't there, mileage wasn't there. And so people basically got discouraged, and only a few outliers were interested in trying. And what that did for us is that when we went out in the market doing our field trips and, you know, just road shows, people had a preset opinion and said, nope, if it's electric, it can't climb a hill. It can't carry a load. It can't do this. And so we had to spend a lot of time and energy demonstrating to people that our motorbike can actually compare very favorably with a petrol motorbike. So that really has been a big part of the resistance around adoption. It's still new, so we don't have that many. I think in Kenya, we probably have in the region of 9,000 electric motorbikes. I think that's an estimate as of this time, halfway through 2025. If you're lucky, maybe you're at 10,000. So the market is very new. It's very young. The people are curious, and there are people still willing to make the try. The arguments for, of course, are the cost savings. That's the biggest argument people are able to prove for themselves and then begin the adoption. And then, of course, the other bottleneck, of course, is availability of swap stations. We have thousands of petrol stations in Kenya, so you can buy a motorbike anywhere without thinking about where you'll refuel. You buy an electric bike, you've got to think about where you're going to get your battery. And so that's a bit of a challenge. But yeah, perceptions are changing, but we still have to do a lot of education, a lot of hands-on trials with potential customers. And, you know, we are committed to just keep doing it. Whether they buy or not, we want them to know that it's definitely a viable option.
How do you mitigate the risk of being first to market like that and having to put in all the cost, time, and effort of educating a market? And why I ask the question is that my own personal journey, I was in much the same position in, of course, a totally different industry. And we were the very first to go to market with quite a new technology. We were early innovators in our space. And we spent many years educating a market. And what they say is that second to market usually wins. That the person who goes first is spending all their time, money, resources, and energy educating a market, pioneering, paving the way through. And is there a risk of competitors coming in a second once you've done all the educating? What is your risk strategy or risk mitigation strategy against that happening?
I think generally that is the path that the way business will probably evolve over the next few years. We are part of early entrance into the market. There's a number of us. We're actually one of the smaller players. There are other larger players, but you know, they've gone ahead of us. They've created more availability of units. They've shown people that electric mobility is viable in the two-wheeler space. So I don't know that there's too much we can do in terms of avoiding being in the forefront. It's where we ended up. But our thinking around that has been to do the best in terms of bringing the best product possible to market. So whereas we know that those who came in before us brought a product to market, quite an imperfect product, we knew, you know, in the sense coming slightly behind that, we thought, well, our best bet to mitigate the risk of all this resistance from people's lived experience with petrol, their familiarity, it's working. You know, still the petrol border industry is still profitable for riders. What we offer is more than what they're making for the same effort. So people still need an argument for why should I switch? And so we've focused on quality and performance. We've spent a lot of time getting the bike right. We've gone through four iterations. Our go-to-market bike is our fourth iteration bike. We've changed our mind several times. We've changed technology. We've changed ideas. We've thought, you know, we've tried things that worked and didn't work. So it's cost us money, but it's also cost us time because we wanted to take the time to get a product which we felt once we start selling, we can keep going with a lot of confidence and without having to kind of fix things falling apart behind us, especially with customers. Because customers, once the sentiment turns against you, it's very expensive to turn it back for you. So we felt we need to get customer sentiment to be as positive as possible right from the get-go. And so the other thing we did was embed ourselves in a local community where we set up our service station, our charge station. Substation is in a local community just outside the border of Nairobi, so that we are part of a community rather than just a sales office or outlet. So being a part of community while we are doing R&D meant we kept calling riders in, take a bike, go take it for a day, take it for 2 days, tell us what you think. And so that developed a kind of symbiotic relationship with our customers or potential customers at the time, where they felt they knew us. And they felt we were listening when they gave us feedback about different aspects of the bike and then saw us make changes to the bike and then bring it back to them. I think that gave us a lot of credibility. People started to think, oh, these guys are not just trying to shove a product in our faces. They're actually trying to meet our need. And so that community work has been, we think, is really the core of how we want our customers to not just think about us, but feel about us, that we are partners in their business and our success is dependent on their success. So we support them to succeed by giving them the best product possible. And then, of course, that enables them to continue, you know, bringing their business to us.
I want to go back a bit to your previous career, spending more than 17 years in church circles, of which 2 years were in the US. Can you please tell us a bit more about your career history?
Yeah, I got out of college early mid-90s, finished university, and my dream was a career in finance. And so I sent out my four application letters. I think I got two regrets, but at the same time, I got a really good friend of mine who had done discipleship with throughout my university years, called me up basically and told me, you know, there's a job that he thinks was basically tailor-made for me. So I went in and got interviewed and got a job with CMS, which was the first Protestant mission organization that brought the gospel to East Africa back in the 1800s. So I had 17 years there, and it was, for me, really, I had the time of my life, I would say. I really, really enjoyed doing work with refugees, with churches in South Sudan, Congo. I did some work in Uganda as well. So in the region, you know, I traveled a bit in the region, worked with a lot of church leaders, doing a lot of relief and church and mission and ministry work. Through it all, however, I did end up handling mostly money. So I was always in the person kind of counting the money, handing out money, making payments, doing reports. And so my kind of introduction to accounting and finance was, you know, through hands-on experience in mission work. This was really a journey of resetting how I thought about things. So, you know, accounting wasn't just in a finance company. Accounting was, in my early experience, ministry. It served so many people, you know, my ability to kind of keep things in a certain level of order served so many people's ability to do their ministry work and mission work. And that really changed the way I saw money, mission, and ministry. Then getting an opportunity to go to the US to set up a similar organization to what was running in East Africa. It came about again, another circumstances working to kind of show that God was in the direction. I applied for a visa in 1999 for a 2-week visit to my brother. Got given a 5-year visa, but I only asked for 2 weeks. And, you know, I went, came back, and a month before the 5 years was up, I was asked, can you come to the US now for an interview? I got on a plane and went. So I used that 5-year visa twice, at the beginning and at the end. And by the time, you know, the end, the visa regime for Kenyans going to the US had become way more difficult. But I didn't have to go through that. I was able to just go. But even that journey of getting to the US was another one, because we literally sold off all our stuff in Kenya, gave up the house, and my wife was pregnant at the time with our firstborn. And then the US, I applied for missionary visa, and they said, this is not a missionary job. You have to make a different application. And so it actually took us another year before we made it to the US. So we were homeless. Then we moved in, you know, with my brother-in-law, because he was single at the time. We, you know, we moved in with friends. We were like, I mean, we literally lived a bit of a refugee life. Thankfully, one of my colleagues from the UK so visited and said, hey, you don't have to do this. We are short-staffed in London. Can you come and help us out in our accounting department? And boom, we went to the UK for a few months to you know, to help out there. And while we were there, that's when the US visa finally came through, and we went to the US for a 2-year stint, which itself was a whole other cross-cultural experience, really, that was tough as nails. You know, it was one of the hardest experiences we had in our early marriage. I think it also shaped our marriage, because we went through that time together, which kind of also reset fundamentals in how we saw ourselves and our roles and how we fit in the world and what kind of service we can offer. In that context, we asked a lot of questions about our relevance. Mm-hmm. And they were not answered at the time, but we came back home to continue working with CMS and setting up an autonomous African-led CMS. You know, it had, for 200 years, CMS was UK-led, and we had a transition to an African-led CMS. So I came back to help with that transition, and then quit. After a few years, felt that God was leading me away from that. He very pointedly, through different circumstances, got me to see that it was His plan for me to leave. And I left and basically jumped out into the deep blue sea. So we had a season where we were working with my wife and a business, small business consultancy, which actually still continues to do this day. And then for some time, again, got into the petroleum industry, which was a family business for about 3 years. Worked with my father-in-law and my wife. We were trying to expand that business. We ran it for a while, and then, you know, at some point had to shut that down just ahead of COVID. And then through COVID is when now the whole e-mobility business came into being.
If we look at your trip to the US, what do you think the biggest lessons were that you learned, and the outcomes, the positive outcomes from taking that risk with God?
I think our trip was about learning to understand literally American and Western culture, mindsets, way of life, I was actually describing this to in an investor meeting yesterday to an American colleague. When we went to the US, we actually, for the first time in our lives, we lived, I would say, below our means, polite way of putting it. our means were never adequate. We were very uncomfortable being on missionary pay in the US for various reasons. One, I think it's because the idea of sending missionaries from Africa to the US is a mind bender for most people. When you go from what is literally a poorer country to a richer country, the whole way people think about costs is they just don't have a framework. So we found we were constantly out of pocket, constantly straining, living paycheck to paycheck for the first time in our lives, because you know we both had jobs, good jobs in Nairobi, and now we're on one paycheck. And then we lived in the inner city, so it was a difficult experience financially. And we started to get to grips with how life can be for people. And I think when you grow up reasonably comfortable, you know, I think everybody grows up with, you know, money is always a conversation. It's a minority that don't have any kind of money challenges. But when you're relatively comfortable, there's a certain level of security that gives you at the back of your mind. You never really gone to bed hungry. You never really had a warm bed or, you know, and, you know, clothes to wear and things like that. So when you're literally having to sit and wait for the bank balance to be credited before you can go, you know, buy your groceries, whether you're out of groceries or not, that for us was a completely new experience. But it made us more sensitive to how people live in Kenya. You see, this was what was God's upside down way of teaching us, because when we were in our own context, a lot of these things are so familiar that we are blind to them. The need and hardship around us, we are almost inoculated to how people around us might live, because it's so familiar. We've grown up aligning ourselves comfortably to the difficulties around us. So we know how to navigate and keep our conscience from being pricked too deeply and having to respond maybe too generously or too sacrificially. It's controlled when we're in our own context. When you're uprooted and taken to a foreign context, then what should have been obvious to us here became way more obvious and stark to us. Our lived experience in the US. So that felt like one of the key lessons God was trying to show us. And I think coming back home has made us way more empathetic to people who live with challenges in terms of the resources, and, you know, affects how our generosity and empathy also for people going through phases of life, where circumstances aren't aligning the way they would like. And it's not always because of laziness or lack of seriousness on their part. Sometimes life can be tough for circumstances beyond our control. So all that kind of sensitivities, I think, came from that US experience. But more than that, I think the more fundamental thing, which I actually sat down and started to write, did a long Bible study for months. In the last few months, we were in the US trying to ask God, what is this about? And it literally ended up, Ephesians 4:13 was kind of the verse it ended up in. I won't quote it word for word, but I'll explain how I understood it. That it takes the whole body of Christ. We are one body in different cultures, different contexts, different circumstances around the world. We are one body of Christ. But the way we best reflect the wholeness of who Christ is to us is when that body goes through the hard work of trying to be one, do the uncomfortable things together. We have to do work together. We have to try and succeed, in a sense, holding hands, even when that is not the most convenient way to do something. It's way more efficient to do it perhaps in our separate ways, in our separate contexts, because, you know, we understand Africa better than non-Africans. Let Africans do Africa kind of thing. But I think my deep conviction now is that humanly speaking, Africa can sort out its own problems and lift itself up. But if we really are one body with people in other parts of the world, you know, in Europe, in America, South America, Asia, we really are one body. We have to do it together. We have to find ways that force us to the table, to the context, into the project together. And then it'll get very messy, but it'll call out all the brotherliness and holiness and that we can muster in us. And literally, it'll be beyond our abilities until all of us literally fall on the mercy of God to help us cope with our really deep anger, resentment, offense that we have taken culturally against one another for whatever different reasons. All of us have some aspect of that going on with people from who are other than the way we are in whatever way.
I love how counterintuitive God is, Ms. Yoki. And when you were talking about God humbling us through tough circumstances, so often we want to believe that God's plan for us is just to be comfortable and happy and healthy and wealthy. And he is so much more concerned with our characters, isn't he? There was a point on my journey in entrepreneurship, after my first business failure, God had used that to humble me and build empathy in me, much like your story. And I remember being left with two dogs that I'd inherited from my mom because she was immigrating, and a potato. And that's all I had. I had hit solid rock bottom in my life. And that night I had to decide who was going to eat. Were the two dogs going to eat the potato, or was I going to eat the potato? And sometimes I can't even talk about the story without wanting to cry. I can already feel the emotion building up. And, you know, it's only when you go through that experience and, you know, you've touched on it, but I know having been through a similar one, there's a lot more to the stories that you've shared, and a lot more pain and depth and humbling. And in those moments, you just think, oh, Lord, where are you? And when we look back, we just see the incredible work that God has done in us and through us. So thank you for sharing that. Then you moved back to Kenya. That was another big leap you touched on. So can you just once again just explain why that move back to Kenya? How did you know that season was up, and how did you hear from God in terms of that big move, especially considering you thought you'd have been there for a longer time?
Yeah, I think the work that I was doing in the US, kind of, at least in my view, was very different from what I expected to do. So, you know, I kind of did it, and I'm happy to do it and happy to be in that context in the sense of the professional experience. But very quickly, we felt, okay, the growth is more outside work than within the work. So when we looked at what we were achieving in terms of our work, my wife at this point was a stay-at-home mom. You know, my wife is a business, hard-nosed businesswoman, entrepreneur, MBA. She's, you know, she's a hard-charging woman. And she had been, in a sense, now was only a homemaker and, you know, babysitter, really, for our daughter. And for her, you know, that was a big change. I don't think she really minds, you know, she minded at that time being at home that much. But when it wasn't feeling like career-wise, either of us was really progressing in our experience, we started to think, well, we don't feel that we can see a future in what we are doing here. We came to do a particular job. I'm not going to look for another job just so that I can stay there. I had a visa, another year on my visa, I could have stayed. She actually got a job offer in Canada. I did a mission conference in Canada, and she got a job offer there. Someone who said, hey, if you want to stay, I'll give you a job and you can move to Canada and stay. When we thought about all those things and said, that feels like staying for the sake of staying. And we've always really felt called to, you know, work in ways that about lifting Africa, changing the narrative about Africa, of course, investing in Africa, being a better Africa for our children than it was for us necessarily. You know, I'm not saying we had that bad an Africa, but, you know, just making the future, building a better future. So, you know, that was in our hearts, and we're in this context where we're doing this out of obedience, and we're saying, okay, I can't see another thing that we are going to gain from being here. And I can see a whole lot of gain from moving back because, you know, like I said, one of the things that was happening then was CMS was creating an autonomous African-led entity so that it was not longer going to be, in a sense, answerable to London, you know, after over 200 years. So that felt like a project that was right up our street in terms of how we felt, you know, we wanted to contribute. I think one of the things also I might say in terms of lessons for the US, one of the things we experienced in the US was a lot of disconnectedness relationally. it was very difficult connecting and building community. Now, we did manage to do some of that. We have made some really wonderful friends there. But we did feel also for our children. We felt our own connectedness to family, extended family, and, you know, extended family, like, you know, as Africans, it's your neighbor, your cousin's neighbor can be your family. And, you know, all sorts of people connect, and connections are really a big part of how we feel our identities evolves. So we really felt keenly that our daughter was going to grow up. It was almost, we were actually afraid, because we would meet these kids around where we lived and we'd engage with them and think, can you imagine our daughter growing up without knowing that she has her people? So that really was another dimension which made us say, Nana, we have a project and we've got to do this for our children. I'd rather they come, if they're going to go to the West, let them go as adults, but they have their foundations in the culture of Africa, so that they have an identity, in a sense, a foundation to face the world from, and not an identity that's given to them outside of, you know, where they come from.
Ms. Yoki, your journey with CMS has been a fascinating one to listen to, and it's been a thread that's woven through your story and your journey. So when you left CMS to start your entrepreneurial journey, was the work complete? Was that done? Was that the final chapter closing on your relationship with the organization?
No, far from it. Like I'd said earlier, you know, I was coming back to help Dennis and CMS transition into an autonomous African organization. But autonomy was not about being independent and standing alone and being not needing the relationships and connections built over 200 years of joint mission work with the church in the UK. It was really about having an African-led mission organization that Africans were accountable to other Africans, so that we can think and pray and strategize around our context, but also how we see a resourcing of mission work even beyond our borders. So that conversation is ongoing even today. But for me, by the time I was leaving, we had gone deep into a project which was about making CMS in Africa financially sustainable for the long term. And that turned out to be a real estate project. When we looked at what do we have in hand, we had a property. It was in a you know, a growing part of the city. And so we worked to put together a project plan to turn that into a commercial property. It was, you know, a residential house on a lot of land. So we were able to turn that into an office block. That project itself was very challenging. You know, that was one of the projects I conceived of with Dennis Tongoi on the beaches of New Haven. We came back and worked on putting together the actual project plan. But it was literally years before we were able to put together the financing structure. And so by the time I left, we were only halfway through that. And I continued to work on that project with Dennis and support him on that. Of course, he carried a huge burden himself, really. I can't even take credit for most of what he did. But I was, you know, because we had dreamt of it together, I think he kept me in the loop and I attended meetings and supporting in different aspects that I could. Fundraising meetings with investors. It took a really long time. It was excruciatingly difficult navigating people in the UK looking at us doing this real estate project and believing that it would succeed. You know, there was so much fear that we were biting off more than we could chew. Again, these are kind of different risk appetites from different cultures. Here in Kenya, we were gung-ho and we're like, this is going to work. People overseeing from the UK were a bit more cautious, asked more different kinds of questions. But, you know, we felt we had to do it. And to their credit, you know, they were sincere in giving us the autonomy to make those decisions. And even when we didn't agree, they let us kind of go on with our decisions. And that's kind of formed the basis of what I think is a healthy relationship, where we do consult both ways. We were interested in each other's opinions. But at the end of the day, we have to make the decisions that we think are right for our context. And it's part of what I was talking about, the Ephesians 4:13, about the body of Christ working together. I think that's vital for how we see mission going forward. And if we can do more projects like that, commercial projects and other projects that are now mission and in Africa to be funded through resources coming out of Africa, I think we reduce the burden on our brothers and sisters from outside Africa, but also release resources to go to other different priorities, because we are also able to contribute more than perhaps we have done in the past.
So God then jolts you out of your comfort zone into taking this risky leap into business. How did that start or come about? I mean, to go from missions and finance into electric vehicles, that's quite a shift.
It is. It's an amazing shift. And I think when I went into business, I was trying to do this consultancy with my wife. And it was the driest period of our lives. We were broke. And it was a struggle like we've never seen before. We thought America was tough. This was tougher because now we had three children. And like I keep saying, kids get hungry every day. For us, it was just dry and hard. And it felt like we were working very hard for and getting nothing out of it for some years. A few years, I think I probably did about 3 years of that kind of season. And then it felt again, another opportunity came about where my wife's business with her father, they ran a petroleum station. The opportunity was to open up a new branch and perhaps begin to think of expansion. So I thought, okay, if you're talking about expansion, then that might be something I'm interested in. So I got into the petroleum industry. So for 3 years, I was selling petrol. And interestingly, that really is the foundation for the e-mobility business we are in now. So in the moment, it felt like supporting them in their business, my in-laws in their business. And, you know, yes, it helped stabilize things for us at home, but career-wise, it felt like supporting them. Looking back, I think it was about understanding how the mobility business works. So, you know, when you're working in a business that's petroleum is commoditized, petrol stations, you know, they sell the exact same product. You know, petrol is petrol, regular is regular, premium, you know, diesel is diesel. It's just different. It's Shell or Total or Olivia or Rubis or whatever. The branding is different. Maybe the customer experience is slightly different. Some are better than others. And that's not even necessarily the brand. It's usually the operator who makes the difference. So all this, I spend a lot of time trying to understand what the need was that a business like that was actually meeting. Why do people choose our petrol station other than another petrol station? When we have a great month, what did we do right? When we have a poor month, what did we do wrong? You know, in my efforts to try and say, how can you really grow this kind of a business? It's a franchise. It's everyone has one. They all look the same, you know, and they're all selling the same product. And, you know, I really feel that because of that business, when we got into e-mobility, my perspective was enhanced. I understand what need we have to meet to our customers, because in petrol, they have a choice of petrol stations to go to, but nobody goes to a petrol station if they don't have to. So their need to be met is to keep moving. You look at your fuel gauge when you're way home and you make a call. I know where I'm going in the morning tomorrow. I'm not going anywhere far. So even if your fuel tank is at a quarter, you might still just go home and say, I can do that tomorrow. But if you're going home and you know you're going to leave at 6 in the morning on a long trip, you might stop at the petrol station. So really, your stop is not, it's based on your movement plan and your estimates around that. And so in e-mobility, that's kind of how we have built our business, trying to see how do we ensure any rider of our bikes is never hindered from their ability to move because of a lack of access to either charge batteries or even on the maintenance and service side. We are very hands-on in terms of maintaining our motorbikes. We had an incident with our motorbikes where one of our riders got hit by a truck. I think he called them minibuses here, matatus here. And, you know, the front wheel was bent off and broken parts and everything, sitting on the side of the road. And our team literally went out there, picked up that bike, transported it to the service station. And in 3 hours, we had changed out his parts, fixed everything, and put him back on the road to go continue making money. And so that's kind of how we see our business, that whether it's just the fuel or the service, if you have our bike, our commitment is that you will never not be able to move. We want you to feel so comfortable that we are supporting you and that we're providing you with the service and support that you take us for granted. That's kind of how I see that business. And I think that was really God using the experience from petroleum to transition into e-mobility. As well, I think our American experience came in handy because e-mobility business, my partner is American, living in Kenya. And I think my ability to work with an American in an entrepreneurial journey, which, as you know, is a very personal, emotional, it's a very deeply intimate when you're having to discuss people's kind of life dreams and plans and dreams of the future and bring them into being together when you're so two very different individuals. And I think just culturally, my ability to relate with him as an American is really comes from us being in America now, what is pretty much 20 years ago. Perhaps my African pride, if I hadn't been in the US, would have been to stand up and say, we don't need them. We can do this on our own. Why are we even talking to them? I think I might have had a bit of an edge around there, but I'm much more open to partnership now. I think I'm much more willing to engage and more sympathetic about where they're coming from, even as they're doing this. They're not always necessarily know our context as much as we'd like them to, but if the heart is in the right place, you know, the rest is a journey for all of us. But today I can say I see several threads from the past coming together in this moment. And I'm appreciative that I took the journey the way I did when I did. You know, I guess in the moment I didn't have confidence moment to moment that I was always doing the right thing. I think that confidence, a lot of things feel better in retrospect. In the moment, it's really hard. It always feels like you're on the edge, like you're being stupid, you're not being wise, you're not being responsible. All sorts of self-doubt comes in. But now looking back, it all kind of, well, not all, I would say. A lot of it makes sense.
Ms. Yoki, you have had a rich risk-taking adventure. And on that note, I'd like to know how you personally define risk, if somebody asked you to define it.
I'd say African, Christian, accountant. So caution is part of my DNA. I actually don't feel like I take risks. What you call risks? I think a lot of it feels to me very calculated and premeditated. So yes, I can see how it looks like big steps and risky steps. But the amount of time and effort that for me spent in the thinking, the reflecting, the praying, the permutations and evaluations has always felt like it's been a way of getting perspective and seeing, making risk not look so risky. So I think risk is just being willing to do something when you don't fully understand what the consequences might be. Because despite all my great efforts at doing that, I'm always conscious that I never really see the whole picture.
I love that. It reminds me a little bit of my journey as well. Because I think if some people look back at my story where I took some big leaps, especially when I was dealing with venture capital and private equity folk, and I said to them, I'm going this long, arduous, expensive journey of manufacturing, product development, tech development, and export. But it could also look like that was just not a very carefully thought out wild strategy. But the amount of time that I spent in prayer, walking with God, in the Word, the incredibly long and rich journey and time that I spent with Him definitely underpins a lot of the risks that I took or leaps of faith. So I love that. We've been chatting to many of our guests about balancing risk and responsibility of being a good steward versus taking those leaps of faith. How do you look at that from your lens?
That's a good question. Those two words, some of the hardest things to balance. And I honestly feel, you know, I think from my journey and my experience tells me to be very cautious about making judgments about anybody other than myself where risk and responsibility are concerned. Because it's so hard for an outsider to understand why you would do something that means that you may not be able to pay your bills because you're saying you're trusting God and you're doing what you think God has called you to. Because your average responsible person, not even necessarily a person of faith, would say, well, you're a provider and you're a responsible parent, means you do a job even if you hate it, because it enables you to meet your obligations. And you have obligations and you have a responsibility to meet those obligations. And you have abilities and skills. It's not like you're disadvantaged or disabled in any way. So do what's right. That's your highest priority. And I wouldn't disagree if someone said those things. And I almost have no defense against that. If someone felt about that, I would just have to smile and kind of accept that and walk away. Because I also know that when you take these risks, because you feel you're doing it out of obedience, it's rarely a pretty picture. You don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. You don't know. You can't answer the immediate questions about paying bills and you know, taking care of your responsibilities in the moment. But you have the faith that this journey will make your ability to do all those things even greater in the future and beyond just you and yours, but the community outside of your family who will benefit from the risk you've taken, the jobs you create, the families that benefit from those jobs, the maybe the wealth you create and the opportunities to give and contribute to all sorts of causes because of that. So you take a risk because you really believe the reward in the long term is going to be greater than the cost in the short term. But I really feel it's very difficult to justify in the moment. And there's a level of humility you have to have and accept the criticisms and rebukes people might offer in their, you know, sometimes it's literally out of love. It's not out of any contempt for what you're doing. But people who love you will have tough meetings to try and set you straight, and you won't have answers. So yeah, those two words, Karen, there you hit the nail on the head. That's the biggest, I think, vulnerability as an entrepreneur that you have, is it's very difficult to justify to anyone outside of, you're lucky if you have a partner or even a wife or a family member who can understand and take you at your word. That's a blessing. If you have even one, that is an outsized blessing, because more often than not, you have seasons where you're alone.
I almost feel that God wants us, because every time you tried to be comfortable, God quickly shifted you. When you wanted to have enough money to take that leap into business, God moved you. And I get the sense, and even from our own experience, that God wants us uncomfortable. He wants us leaning on Him. He wants us trusting Him for our provision and resources, and not leaning on ourselves or our own understanding. So I love what you shared. Thank you.
Thank you.
What's the most significant personal or professional growth you've experienced through taking risk?
It's our US experience. That was it. That was both professional and personal. I think it was kind of a very foundational experience for the rest of my life, myself and my wife, and you know, our kids by extension. That was a huge risk. We left home, left everything behind, went to start a new life, and very quickly we were back home. And it in some ways felt like a failure, like we didn't make it work. But there's so many positives that have come out of that, and like I said, even including NZ as a business. So I think that was the biggest step. That my learning to be empathetic to my brothers and sisters from outside Africa who have such a different lived experience, so that they struggle sometimes to understand what we are going through here. Let me just give you, you know, kind of example about how this kind of works itself out. When we went to the US, one of the things which you start to realize is, again, I was describing this to Americans yesterday. American business environment is very built very strongly to support entrepreneurship. So the regulatory, legal, property laws, logistics infrastructure, all that infrastructure exists. I think we kind of see it from here, but being in America, for me, that was one of the biggest things I saw, is so much that supports Americans to do what they want to do that they don't realize, especially now when they come to Africa, why is it so hard? So, for example, timelines. In America, they can say, this is going to get done in the next 1 week. And there's in a very mechanical way, everything works to help you get it done. When you come here, the same thing, you say it's going to be done in 1 week. And I tell my brothers from that side, it always costs more and it always takes longer. Because everything, you know, power will go off. Tell an American you didn't do it because the power went off. Like, what do you mean power went off? So some of my, I think, empathy when I'm speaking to them and their frustrations with us for, oh, you said this would be done, you know, by this time it's not done. I know where they're coming from. And I'm not as frustrated as I think I would be if I thought, I would probably have interpreted it as arrogance, pride, superiority complex, looking down on us and all sorts of other negative things. But now I'm I can see it more as it's where they're coming from. They've never seen these things as obstacles, and they're unaware at how, you know, some of them are very successful businessmen, but they are unaware at how the environment facilitated that. You know, I don't know that Elon Musk could be a billionaire if he had stayed in South Africa. But it's the same guy, you know. So then you shift the environment and your ability to function changes dramatically. I honestly believe without that 2 year stint, man, I would have been swinging hard at Americans. But, you know, it's where they come from. When we're in the US, we had our telephone went dead for a few hours and we got a credit in our bill because of that.
Wow. Imagine that. I'm going to send this podcast to Eskom, Musyoki, because I'm going to let them know that every time the power goes out here in South Africa, we need to be accruing a credit on our electricity bill.
We've tried it here. It doesn't work.
Probably won't. But you're so right. I remember in my own business, trying to build a business, and our telephone lines would be cut. I would be in the middle of a conversation to America or England or some country that wanted to import our goods. And you could actually hear the very moment that the lines, the cables were being cut and stolen. And I often thought, if I can build a successful business in South Africa, and I guess on the continent of Africa, most of our countries, we could probably do it with our eyes closed in first world countries where things work. And you wonder and you think God's planted us here and we need to be faithful here where he's planted us with the mandate and what he's given us to do. And may he use you powerfully in those endeavors of bridging those gaps between nations and communities and cultures. It's been absolutely wonderful chatting to you, Musyoki. Thank you so much for sharing your stories, your insight, your wisdom. What I gleaned most out of our conversation today is that with God, we play the long game and we need to just trust him, allow him to humble us and build empathy, to lead us step by step, and then to hold on with dear life. Relationships are key. We learned that from you today, and that when you include community in your innovation journey and seek to first add value and ensure your customers' success and your community's success, their success becomes your success. And most importantly, that Ephesians 4:13, we are part of one body and God wants us to unify globally, across cultures and boundaries and countries and continents. Thank you so much, Musyoki. God bless you on your journey and where God takes you next. We are watching this space with eager anticipation.
Thank you very much.
Awesome.
Thank you for joining us. This episode of Reframed was brought to you by Ziwani, a community of business leaders who partnered together to live out their kingdom calling in the marketplace within Africa. To know more about us, visit our website at ziwani.com. That's ZIWANI.com.